I wouldn't say this is an intimate setting because there are a lot of people here. I hear there's people in other other floors of the building. But this is not something that's fun, that's kind of, you know, dinner conversation. This is something that's usually shared, maybe shared, between people who know each other, who feel close enough to each other that they can kind of experience pain together. But we're going to talk about it today because as Jewish people entering into the week of Tisha B'Av, this is a collective pain that we experience with each other. I'm going to start with a story that maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't, but it's amongst medievalists, Jewish medievalists. It's a pretty well-known story. It comes from the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles, which is eyewitness reports on the Crusades in the Middle Ages, right? And it's the story of Rachel of Mainz. Rachel of Mainz, what the chronicles tell us, the chronicles, again, written by Jews who survived and or witnessed the Crusades, lived through the Crusades. Rachel of Mainz, the chronicles tell us, was a woman who saw to the slaughter of her four children. I say saw to the slaughter of her four children because it's very unclear in the text whether the slaughter of her four children happened by her own hand, or whether she solicited somebody else to do it. In either case, the result, the tragic result, was that her four children on that auspicious day in 1096 were killed. Yes. Go up. I should use the microphone? I speak loudly to begin. Okay, so we'll try our best. Okay. In this story that's very, very poignant and evocative in the Crusade Chronicles, if you read the actual story, there's a gender difference between her sons and her daughters. She has two boys and two girls as to how they react to the fact that she's going to see to their slaughter because she's afraid that they're going to be baptized. That's the main reason why parents did things like this during the Crusades, because their main fear was that their children would be baptized. This is called the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles. The Chronicles on the Crusades, written by Jews in Hebrew during the Middle Ages. No, that's in Tanakh. This is a source, a manuscript that we have from the Middle Ages that the Jews of France and Germany wrote. It's a Jewish manuscript that's written in Hebrew by Jews who survived and witnessed the Crusades, lived through the Crusades. One of her little sons, Aaron, runs away and says, please don't do it. She has a son, Yitzchak, and there are a lot of little boys, Yitzchak, in the Crusade Chronicles who submit willingly to their slaughter, which is reminiscent of Akedat Yitzchak. This is all rhetorical flourishes, authorial intent. The authors are putting in names and putting the words. You know, nobody was hiding under the bed when Rachel of Mainz did this and was writing it all down, right? The Rachel of Mainz probably was a real person who actually existed, but the kind of flourishes she gives out, she stands up there and she gives like a whole treatise before she does, you know, a beautiful elegiac poem, you know, that she gives in the source before she does this. That probably didn't happen, right? That's all the author kind of giving little flourishes here and there. So the fact that there are all these Yitzchak, these little Yitzchak boys that submit willingly and passively to their own slaughter, you know, again, like evokes Akedat Yitzchak in some way. They're the sacrificial child, you know? And the girls sharpen the knives. The girls women throughout the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles submit themselves wholeheartedly to God and actively look to be Mekadesh Hashem. They actually look to Mekadesh to be Mekadesh God's name in a way that men and boys don't seem to. But in either case, this story is representative of many stories of child, you know, the martyrdom, the Kiddush Hashem of children and their parents in the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles and these reports from the Middle Ages. And this gut-wrenching story, which, you know, if you read it, you can really evoke tears and pathos and sadness, and this phenomenon that it represents of child martyrdom has become a focal point of Tisha B'Av for us. Tisha B'Av is ostensibly about the Churban Bayit, about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. But if you look at the keynote themselves, and if you look at some of the things that we read on Tisha B'Av, it's not only about the Chorban Bayit. In fact, the first kina that we have that's not specifically about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is the first one that you have on your sheet. A lot of these are excerpts because they're part of much longer things, and you would have, you know, I would have to make 20 pages worth of source sheets. Right, so there are little snippets here. We're going to look at the first kina that you have on your source sheet here. It's kina chaf hei, mi tein roshi mayim, and it says we'll look at the second part first. You know, the second little paragraph there. Simu na alavavchem maspeid mar lekashra shishkula harigatam lehitabel ulahat afra kesrefat beit Eloheinu haulam v'habira ki ein lahosif moed shavar v'tivara. This Kina tells us explicitly that Tisha B'Av is supposed to be an all-encompassing day that includes in it many, many tragedies of the Jewish people, that we're not supposed to add another day. We're not supposed to add another day for the Crusades. We're not supposed to add potentially another day for the Holocaust. We're not supposed to add another day for the many other tragedies that Jews have experienced, for, you know, various pogroms and 1888, you know, the Khmelnytsky massacres and all these kind of things. Tisha B'Av is the repository, the catch-all day for all of the tragedies, because all of the tragedies stem from one tragic source. The Chorban. The Chorban was the moment of destabilization and decentralization of Jewish culture and Jewish life. The Chorban, the Beit HaMikdash, was the spiritual, economic, social, political, religious epicenter of the Jewish experience. And when it was destroyed, the whole Jewish fabric, the whole essence, core of our personality and our existence was shattered. And that's why all of the other tragedies happened. They stemmed from that one moment. And so Tisha B'Av, as we mourn this destabilization of the Jewish people, we mourn everything, all the aftershocks, all the after effects of that destabilization. So Tisha B'Av is the day where we mourn the Chorban and incidents like the Crusades. My question is, because we see child martyrdom, children specifically, represented over and over and over again in the sources about the Crusades, and as a result, over and over again in the keynote, and as you look at the keynote on Tisha B'Av, notice where you see children. I'm trying to understand why children specifically are at the center of this tragedy, this bemoaning, this mourning, this grief. What did children mean to the medieval Jew, the medieval Jews of Ashkenaz specifically? We're talking about Jews of France and Germany, to the extent that the destruction, the demise, the slaughter of children comes to epitomize in some way the grief that we feel on Tisha B'Av. In order to understand that, we have to understand what children meant to Jews in the Middle Ages in general, under happy times. Okay? If we understand what they meant, what it meant to have a child, to raise a child for a Jew in the Middle Ages, then we can understand the depth of the grief that they had when their children met their end, right? And it's different, you know, it may seem to all of us that it's elementary. We understand what a child means, right? We understand that a child represents innocence, represents the future, represents our legacy, whatever it is. We each have different emotions and approaches to child rearing and to our children and to the value that children have. But as a historian, I try to understand what the particulars are in terms of different epochs, different ages, and how they specifically, what iteration of childhood existed in that particular moment in time, and how it might be different than how we view children. And I think together we'll learn something very interesting about childhood for Jews in the Middle Ages. Now we get to maybe the few moments of ease where we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to have a little bit of a happier tone. Jews in the Middle Ages had, in medieval Ashkenaz specifically, had some very interesting rituals when it came to their children that you may or may not know about. The first we learn from Sefer Hasidim, which is a book by the medieval Hasidim, not to be confused with the ancient Hasidim during the Maccabean era, or the Hasidim of the Baal Shem Tov, or the Hasidim of today in America versus Israel, post-Hasidus, or any other permutation of Hasidut. There were Hasidim in the Middle Ages who were, as opposed to the halachic, Talmudic Tosafists, they were ethicists. They were contemplative, they were meditative, they focused on ethics and morals and improvement of the self. They were very mystical, they were very superstitious, and they were a very interesting group of people. And in their Sefer Chasidim, they tell us about the first real ritual associated with children in the Middle Ages. It's the first one associated with children because it happens in the cradle. When a baby boy, yes, we're talking a lot about boys here, that's a whole other discussion. When a baby boy was born, he was put in his little cradle, and he was given things that babies are given in their cradles, in their cribs. What are babies given in their cradles, in their cribs? What are some things that we put in? Rattles, mobiles. Okay, sure, but they weren't doing that yet. The wimple itself came in the 14th century. That was used at the bris, and then it was used to wrap the Torah, and then it was used for the chata, for the chuppah. So those things came later. I don't know if they put pillows. I know we're not supposed to do that anymore, right? Or the thing that goes around the crib. What's it called? I don't know. Whatever, right? So we're just supposed to have a baby wearing nothing in a crib, lying on its back, right? That's where it's supposed to have. In either case, what they put in their crib, which we might not put in our children's cribs, was Sefer Vayikra. Says in the first source on your the second source on your sheet, Sefer Chasidim, Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam. This is referring, Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam is a quote from the book of Genesis from Bereishit, which is at the time when Sefer Bereishit is about to tell us about the generations. Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam, here's a book of the generations of man, and it's about to tell us a whole bunch of stuff about the generations. So, I don't know how much commentary you can get from that, but Sefer Chasidim says from the word generations, we have a remez, right? Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam, mikan remez, kemesimin hana'ar be'eres v'karin lo shem, masimim sefer shel Torah kohanim mirashotav. We have a remez from the fact that Sefer Bereishit, there you go all over the place, the fact that Sefer Bereishit says the word generations, toldot, maybe it has the shoresh of yeled or something like that, right? Toldot, this is the generations of man. We have a remez, a hint to the fact that we're supposed to put Sefer Vayikra at the head of the child. And it goes on to tell us that children, why Sefer Vayikra? Right, you think Sefer Bereishit, a Sefer about, a book about birth and renewal, right? And beginnings and things like that. No. Sefer Vayikra, which is about karbanot, sacrifices, because children are pure like sacrifices, okay? You already get the sense, and we're not going to spend that much time on this, but you already get the sense that there's some kind of analogy between children, the purity of children, the purity of sacrifices, the sacrificial child, all these kind of things, which, again, we're not going to go into too much because there are other things that can even interest us more. And that's what they did. They took Sefer Vayikra and they put it by the child's head. They want the child to become one with Sefer Vayikra. The child is analogous to Sefer Vayikra in some way, paralleling Sefer Vayikra. The child is pure, Sefer Vayikra is pure, etc. But there's an even more interesting ritual that I was surprised to learn about. Every Shavuot, and I'm conscious of the time, every Shavuot, we're not talking about Tisha B'Av, now we're talking about Shavuot for a minute. Every Shavuot, all boys who had turned 5 years old that year were brought into the shul, were brought into the synagogue with a lot of fanfare. They were paraded throughout the street. They were wrapped in a tallit in order to protect them from heebie-jeebie shadim demons, right? These are, we're talking about Sefer Chasidim a lot, and they believed in those kind of things. They were wrapped in a tallit. They were paraded through the streets with a lot of fanfare, meaning like a hachnasat sefer Torah, right? There were people, to the extent that it was politicized, the most important people were closest to the child, and then the less important people were a little bit further out, until you get, the nobodies again on the outside, whatever. In other words, this was an important event, and the thing that was at the center, the child, was an important commodity, to the extent that the important people got to be closer to the child, right? And there was singing, and there was dancing, and they're parading through the street, on this like journey until they get to the synagogue, until they get to the shul where the child's future Rebbe is waiting on the bima, on the podium. They brought the child to the Rebbe and the child began to teach the child Torah, starting with Sefer Vayikra, okay? Again, because of the same parallel between children and sacrifices when it comes to purity. This is what scholars call the child initiation ceremony, where children were inducted into the world of Jewish education, little boys, five-year-old boys. It's the precursor to today's upsharon, but there was no sharon going on. They didn't cut any hair. That has its own history. But this was the beginning of that ceremony that some people do today. That, you know, Hasidically origined, that's not a word, ceremony. And this was when the child started to learn Torah. We have seven sources from the Middle Ages that tell us about this ceremony, some of which you have on your sheets. I hope you can see it. Mine is very dark. I think yours might be a little bit lighter. We have the Sefer HaRokeach. This is a little excerpt you have from the Sefer HaRokeach, Sefer HaAsufot, and the Machzor Vitri in English. That's in the back of Ivan Marcus's book. Ivan Marcus is a famous medievalist from Yale. He wrote a book called Rituals of Childhood that described this ceremony in detail based on these seven sources. And in these seven sources, we're told some very interesting things. We're told that the child not only is inducted into the world of Jewish learning by learning Sefer VaYikra, but also eats honey cakes. There are round honey cakes. Have you heard of this? Honey cakes with psukim written on them, eggs with psukim written on them, and the child is literally asked to ingest the words of Torah, right? So the child is paraded throughout the streets as wrapped like a Torah scroll is wrapped, paraded throughout the streets like a haknasat sefer Torah, and becomes a literal physical container of Torah. They invoke the pasuk from Yechezkel that you have on your sheet as well, Yechezkel Perek Gimel, Psukim Aleph to Gimel, the pasuk where Yechezkel is told to literally eat a scroll with words of Torah on it. You know that pasuk, right? Ezekiel is told to eat a scroll with, and that's what they see their children is doing when they're eating these honey cakes with words of Torah written on them. They're literally becoming one with Torah, taking the Torah, the words of Torah, becoming a container for Torah, taking the words of Torah into their body. So one of the sources I thought would be interesting to look at for this ceremony is the Leipzig Machzor that you have on the bottom over there, which illustrates the ceremony for us, which shows us what actually happens. On the right folio, you see anybody who's wearing that triangular hat, which is a Judenhut, a Jewish hat from the Middle Ages, as a grown-up, right? They didn't wear kippahs, they didn't wear black hats, they didn't wear shtreimels, they wore Judenhuts, which were these triangular hats. They're usually illustrated in medieval manuscripts as being yellow. We've never found one. If you ever find one, I would love to see it. Scholars don't know what they were made of. Some have said they're made of gold because they're always yellow, but I feel like that would be really hard to wear on your head. And maybe the fact that we don't have them indicates that they were made out of something biodegradable, like canvas or something like that. I don't know. In either case, we don't have any Judenhuts, but we have illustrations of Judenhuts. Those are all medieval Jews wearing their little Judenhuts. And you see the smaller figures that don't have the Judenhuts are the little children. And they're holding some round things. Those are the cakes and whatnot. Figure who's on the left side of the rightmost folio is the teacher on the bima who the children are being brought to. All the way on the right, there's that big blob in color. It's in blue. That is a fourth part of the ceremony that only one of the sources tells us about. The Sefer HaAsufot tells us about this part. Aside from the leaving of the house, the sojourning through the street, the induction into the world of education, the Sefer HaAsufot adds this other ceremony that they would do afterwards by water. They would do this, they would do these, say these different incantations against shadim and demons and evil powers next to a riverbank, next to some water. But only one of the sources tells us about that. So we have the children really being treated like Sifrei Torah as they enter the synagogue. The sources tell us, and I underline some things for you, some key kind of phrases for you to look at on your own in the source. People would stand up, people would kiss like this, right? The child / Sefer Torah. They're really being treated like, not as if they're Sifrei Torah, but as Sifrei Torah, embodiments of Sifrei Torah themselves, especially since they literally contain words of Torah after eating those honey cakes. And so, by the way, just thinking about Shavuot for a second, while Shavuot nowadays is a very adult-centered holiday, In the Middle Ages, it was a completely child-centered holiday. It wasn't grown-ups getting the Torah. It was children, in this kind of ritualized metaphor, children who were receiving the Torah. It was a day of Matan Torah for children. They were a juvenile covenantal community, so to speak. That's who was getting the Torah in shul every Shavuot, which is very, very interesting. It's very, very interesting to think about. So children being associated with Torah in this very intimate, very, you know, almost visceral, you know, physical kind of way, they are actually Sifrei Torah, being treated as Sifrei Torah, is very medieval. Honey, specifically, the fact that they had all these honey cakes, you know, honey in many sources is seen as Torah, right? Honey is milk and honey are analogous to Torah. What I put I put one source on the sheet, just you know, from Tehillim, that shows this is one of many sources that make a parallel between Torah and honey. And then the other source that you have on your sheet are specifically medieval sources, the Yalkut Shimoni. This is one of my favorite midrashim. The Yalkut Shimoni is 13th century midrashist, right? The Yalkut Shimoni is a medieval source, meaning the same people who had this elaborate child initiation ceremony are the same people that wrote this midrash. They know this midrash. Okay, this is from the Middle Ages, and this is what this midrash tells us, which also gives us an inkling into this notion of the child as containing words of Torah and being literal embodiments of Torah. This is what the Yalkut Shimoni tells us. It's a commentary on Shemot, on Sefer Shemot. It's at the point where it's a medrash at the point of the Torah where the Bnei Israel are throwing their children into the Nile, and it says as follows. At that moment, God tells the angels, "Redu milfanai v'ra'u bnei chavivai Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov, shemashlichim otam b'na'ar, v'yardu milfanav k'shehayu muvuhalin." God tells them to the angels to go down and see what Bnei Israel are doing, and they went in a big tumultuous kind of descent. Va'amdu b'mayim ad arkuvotehem, and these angels descended and stood in the Nile River until the water went to their ankles. And if you know about rabbinic descriptions of angels, you can imagine this. Angels are supposed to be huge, like huge towering, you know, skyscrapers, and they have these massive wings and one foot, right? And they're standing in the Nile River it goes just to their ankles because they're so huge and they're so tall. And you see angel, 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 right? That's what the Yalkut Shimoni is describing here. And they would catch the falling babies. As Bnei Israel, as the Israelites were throwing their children into the Nile River, the angels were catching the falling babies. Umanichin otam agabe haslaim, and they were resting them gently on the rocks, on the riverbank, on the side. V'Hakadosh Baruch Hu mevi lahem dadin min haslaim, and God brought forth breasts from the rocks. Umanikam, and He nursed them. L'kayeh mashen emar v'yenikenu dvash misela, like it says in the pasuk that God, you know, gave oil and honey from the rock. Right? So these, just imagine these little babies on the side, they're nursing, they're suckling on the rocks, and there's honey coming out, there's oil coming out. Oil, honey, what is coming out? If rabbinic literature sees oil and honey as represented by oil and honey, it could be that what God is suckling from the rocks is Torah. And in fact, the Yalkut Shimoni goes on, look at the next paragraph, and says as follows. The Yalkut Shimoni is parsing out different psukim, and we're just going to look at the last part of the next Yalkut Shimoni. Vayani keu dvash misela, right? That's the pasuk the Yalkut Shimoni just invoked in order to talk about God suckling the babies. Zum mishnah, vishemen michalamish sur ze Talmud. Literally, what's in the Yalkut Shimoni's mind, what's coming out of the rocks are words of Torah. God is nurturing and sustaining these babies by allowing them to, affording them the opportunity to suckle on words of Torah. They are literally ingesting words of Torah, and that is how they are surviving. And I just put a little picture that, it looks like a big picture, but where I originally found it, whatever it was, like a year and a half ago, it was tiny. It's a tiny little miniature. And I found it in what's a relatively well-known Haggadah called the Shik Haggadah, Arthur Schick's Haggadah. Anybody know about this Haggadah? It's a beautifully illustrated Haggadah. It makes sense that I would find something potentially about, because it's the Haggadah, right? So it's talking about Pesach, it's talking about this exact time when Paro made the decree that you have to throw babies into it, right? So I was at my Pesach Seder, and I saw right next to Birkat HaMazon, which is about nourishment, which is about God sustaining us, right? There's a little tiny, he has beautiful, big, elaborate, dramatic pictures. This one is tiny, so hard to see. There's this little picture of babies suckling from rocks. And I don't know if Arthur Schick knew about the Algol Shimoni. He must have, right? I mean, why would he come up with this himself, right? But this is a pretty obscure Algol Shimoni, so it's interesting that he knew of it, right? So he maybe was more learned than some people give him credit for. That's a really beautiful illustration of God's nourishment, because it's the moment, that little babies needed nourishment, and they were nourished according to the Medrash that invokes this image on Torah itself, which is analogous to oil and honey and whatnot. And so Jews of the Middle Ages see their children as being nourished by words of Torah and becoming literal containers for the words of Torah. Just, and I know my time is so, so short, but I just wanna talk about one more Medrash, because I also think it's so beautiful and so interesting. The Medrash Tehillim that you have, the next Medrash that you have on your sheet, is not medieval. But it could have been, it was known, it could have been, in the minds of the medieval people like Yalkut Shimoni, who wrote the Medrash, because it was a well-known rabbinic Medrash, right, from the ancient period. And they knew Midrashim, they were Talmidei Chachamim, right? And this Medrash, just to put it out there, it's just so beautiful, just so that you know it, is a Medrash about about the first people to have received the Torah. The first people. Who do you think it was? You're so smart. Okay, so this Medrash tells us that when God wanted to give the Torah to the Jewish people, to the Israelites, they weren't called Jews yet because they hadn't entered Judea, so they were still Israelites. When God wanted to give the Torah to the Israelites, to Bnei Israel, he went to them and he said, I need to have guarantors. This is a contract. You need guarantors on a contract that what I give you is going to be kept, that you're going to keep this contract that I'm about to give you. And the Jewish people say, we'll give you our best people, we'll give you our judges, we'll give you our shoftim, we'll give you, those are our judges, our leaders, our elders, we'll give you. And God keeps saying, no, 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 no. And they say, what do you want from us? We offered everybody to you. So God says, I want you to bring me the children. And according to the Medrash, you can read it in its original, you can read it in Hebrew, in English, if you, whatever you want. The Jewish people, Bnei Israel, bring their children, and God says, I'm going to take this even further. And he, according to the Medrash, he makes the wombs of the pregnant women like glass, transparent. He makes it like glass so that he could talk to the fetuses. Not only the children, but to the fetuses. And he says, children, fetuses and children, I don't think he actually calls them that, but he says, my dear ones, or whatever it is, right? He tells them the whole Torah. He tells them the Torah. Right? Et cetera. And he says, after each one, he says, do you agree? Do you agree? Do you agree? Do you accept this? Do you accept this to the extent that you will be guarantors that your parents will listen to it? And after each one, they have to say, yes, yes. Yes, we agree. So the first people to have received the Torah, according to the Medrash, are children. Children are the primary receivers of Torah in a very, mature kind of way. There was consciousness. There was decision making. They rationally conceded. They voluntarily conceded to keeping this Torah. So children and Torah are extremely closely connected in the medieval mind, based on rabbinic ancient midrashim like this. So that's within the context of happier times. Children are embodiments of Torah. They're also, by the way, in that initiation ceremony, they're not only embodiments of Torah, but they are the embodiments of, obviously, the Jewish people themselves, right? They are the ones who receive the Torah. They are reenacting Har Sinai Matan Torah on Shavuos. And they're said, those three/four different parts, their leaving of their house, their sojourning, their journey through the Midbar, their acceptance of the Torah is supposed to mimic Bnei Israel's Yetziat Mitzrayim, their sojourn in the Midbar, their receipt of the Torah, their reception of the Torah at Matan Torah. And the fourth one, according to the Sefer HaSufot, by the riverbank, could be said to mimic them standing on the banks of the Jordan as a nation amongst other nations, just like the children themselves in this initiation ceremony are standing as members of the Jewish community, one member amongst many other members. So they're embodiments of Torah, and they're obviously embodiments of the Jewish people themselves. In the sadder times, mentalities don't change. Just as people, medieval Jews, saw their children as embodiments of Torah in happier times, they saw their children as embodiments of Torah, as analogous to Torah in sad times as well. And so the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles and the keynote that were derived from them also see children in this way. Firstly, children as being, you know, kind of like, let's talk about, because I know time's short and I see Zamira getting nervous. Okay. Let's talk about children as Torah. If you look at that first source sheet, again, if you look at that kina, you see that kina talks about the fact that children were enwrapped before they were taken to the slaughter, which is what the kina is talking about, as painful as it is. The Kina describes them as wrapped in their Torah, in their scrolls, in their school books, in their svarim. They were wrapped in their books and carried to the slaughter, right? The Kina, especially Kina Chavbet, talks about children and sages, Talmudei Chachamim, right? Scholars, scholarship, and books of Torah almost in the same breath. They're the same thing. The children wrapped in their scrolls and the scholars were taken to their slaughter, kind of thing, right? So it's normal to see something like that, because that's they saw children and Torah in the same breath. They perceived them as analogous in their minds. The Hebrew Crusade Chronicles, we have one excerpt on your source over here. The Hebrew Crusade Chronicles, it says the Hebrew Crusade Chronicle of Rabbi Solomon Bar Samson has various incidents where it parallels, mirrors, you know, analogizes children and Torah. In this specific excerpt, the women see a Torah scroll being torn asunder. They tear their hair out and they scream and they cry. And they say, this is the Torah scroll that our children kissed. And this is the Torah scroll, they call it Machmad Einenu, the delight of our eyes. That phrase, Machmad Einenu, appears only twice. One in the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles to describe the Torah, and once in a favorite of the medieval Jews, Sefer Yechezkel, to refer to children, the delight of our eyes. So the same phrase that the Bible, the Tanakh, uses to describe children, Machmad Einenu, is used here to describe a Torah which they bemoan as something that their children connected with and kissed, right? So that's somewhere where we see it in the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles. And just as the mothers describe their children as having kissed the Torah in this chronicle, the keynote themselves, if you look at Kina Chavbet, it's the last source on your sheet, the Torah itself is said to mourn for children. It's the second paragraph over there. Torah toga chagri sak v'hit palshi v'parim evel yachid asilacha maspid tamurim. Right? Torah, O Torah, gird yourself in sackcloth, roll yourself in ashes, make yourself mourn for your only son, a bitter lament. Right? So there's this kind of mutuality, reciprocal relationship between children and Torah. When the Torah is being torn asunder, the women see it as if their children are being torn asunder, and the Torah is asked to mourn for children that were actually slaughtered and turned asunder. So in a sense then, and I'm wrapping up now, in a sense then, child martyrdom, right, the destruction of children, the loss of children, was the loss akin to the Chorban Bayit. It was the loss of everything. It was the loss of Torah. It was the loss of the nation. It was the loss of Klal Yisrael Begadol, of everything that the Jewish people valued, that they loved, that was the delight of their eyes, that they cherished, right? It wasn't only for the nation as a whole. When they created these keynotes, they weren't only talking about individual children and individual families that lost, you know, that lost, unfortunately, obviously, the individual souls, but they were talking about a collective loss. The loss of everything that they stood for. Child martyrdom itself, I mean, it's not something that we spoke about extensively, the slaughter of children by Jews' own hands, as opposed to by the Crusaders, because the Crusaders, for the most part, were not out, especially in the early Crusades, were not out to kill children, but to baptize them, right? Under the threat of death, though, you know, so it's a mixed bag. Child martyrdom itself, again, the slaughter of children by Jews' own hands, functions for medieval Jews as a kind of rite of passage akin to the child initiation ceremony. When you read the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles, everything that they were trying to do with the child initiation ceremony during happier times, to include the child into a collective of Am Yisrael, to initiate and induct the child into the collective, into the group, right? To achieve Olam Haba, to achieve paradise for the group and for the people. They use the same discourse, they use the same language, and they use the same imagery when they slaughtered their children. They asked children, for example, they always asked children, they made a point of asking children, do you want this? The child had to say, yes, I accept this, as if it's a decree, just like, you know, God said, you know, lahavdil, but just like God said, do you accept, anochi Hashem Elokecha, right? Which is what they were saying when they were giving the Torah to the children on Shavuos, do you accept this? And the children said, yes, we want this. They did the same kind of ritualistic kind of ceremony, you see it in the Hebrew Crusade Chronicles, with the children, do you want this? And the children have to say yes, and then they do it. And then they describe how the children are then in Shamayim as part of Am Yisrael, as part of a Klal Yisrael in paradise. This kind of death ritual instead of life ritual, we see in some of the keynote that eulogize people that were slaughtered around actually Shavuos time, interesting, in Sivan. There's one keynote that says, on this day that ordinarily would have been a happy day, right, Shavuos, on the day when we ordinarily would have had this nice ceremony where these five-year-old boys come and are given the Torah, is instead a day of extreme darkness, extreme darkness for us. This keynote that you have in front of you says basically this kind of exchangeability, the exchange of the life ritual, of the education ritual, right, for this death ritual could be seen as encapsulated here. It says, "V'lo chasu gever uvira al panim tzvira tifara, aval azru gvura yitera lahalom rosh ulekrot shadra, ve'elemo dabru ba'amira lo zakinu legadelchem l'torah, nakrivchem ko'ola ve'haktara." Neither a man nor a woman showed weakening pity for the children whose faces were like a splendid tiara. Instead, they girded themselves with abnormal courage to do very, very difficult things to imagine and read. Then they addressed them with these words. This is what they said to their children as they were doing the act of Kiddush Hashem. "We merited not to raise you in the Torah's ways." We can't say Torah l'chupa l'masim tovim, right? "Let us bring you nearer to God like burnt offering and incense," right? This act is going to achieve what under ordinary happy circumstances would be achieved through, you know, bris, chuppah, etc., right? And it's not, do I end on a good note? Do I not end on a good note? It's sad. It's terrible, right? This is what Tisha B'Av is about. This is what we're mourning. But I do want to say, and if you'll give me, two more minutes, while Jews in the Middle Ages had all the same hopes that we do, as encompassed by the blessing, the Torah, l'chupa l'masim tovim, they ultimately saw their children achieve those blessings via Kiddush Hashem. Thank God today we have the ability to see our children as small community, small covenantal community and small embodiments of Torah in a positive way. As a former community rabbi's wife, I actually had a rare opportunity with my own children. I did the initiation ceremony with my child, who was actually born around Shavuos time, when he was 3 years old, not 5 years old, and we did the hair cutting part also, like we added, but we did it to whatever extent we could. And there are a few times where I actually use this notion, this medieval notion of children as embodiments of Torah, in a way that consoled me in some way as a woman that I want to put forward for you. For example, on Simchat Torah, when I am in places that won't allow me to hold the Torah, I'm not making a judgment on that, whether it's right or wrong. I do think about this as I dance with my children, when I dance with other children. It's not ki'ilu I'm dancing for the Sefer Torah. If I'm putting myself in the shoes of a medieval Jew, I have the Sefer Torah in my arms. And I don't know how many of you know the Journeys song, The Man from Vilna. Yeah? You're thinking about it? It's an incredible, incredible story. There's a Rabbi Leo Goldman, who told this story. I think it was on a plane. He met one of the people from Journeys, right, the Jewish group, not the 1980s group. that's Journey, I don't know, whatever. He met one of them on a plane, and he told him a story that when he went back, he was in the war, he was a soldier in the war, he later became a rabbi in Detroit. When he went back after the war was over, he helped escort a whole bunch of Jews, you know, displaced Jews, back to Vilna. And when they got to Vilna, you know, after a long, long and arduous trek, they found, it was Simchat Torah, and they found the shul in complete disarray. The Torah scrolls were burnt up, all the siddurim were burnt up, and they couldn't celebrate Simchat Torah. And I'm just going to read you the lyrics, some of the lyrics of the song, because this tells us the rest of the story, okay? We ran as one toward the shul, our spirits in a trance, and we tore apart the barricade. In defiance, we would dance. But the scene before our eyes shook us to the core, scraps of siddur, bullet holes, bloodstains on the floor. Turning to the eastern wall, we looked on in despair. There'd be no scrolls to dance with. The holy ark was bare. Then we heard two children crying, a boy and girl whom no one knew, and we realized that no children were among us but those two. We danced round and round in circles as if the world had done no wrong, from evening until morning, filling up the shul with song. Though we had no Sifrei Torah to gather in our arms, in their place we held those children. The Jewish people would live on. We danced round and round in circles as if the world had done no wrong, from evening until morning, filling up the shul with song. Though we had no Sifrei Torah to clutch and hold up high, in their place we held those children. Am Yisrael Chai. We danced round and round in circles as if the world had done no wrong, from evening until morning, filling up the shul with song. Though we had no Sifrei Torah to gather in our arms, in their place we held those children. The Jewish people would live on. Am Yisrael Chai. The Jewish people will live on. Right? So there's this analogy, again, between children and Sifrei Torah. That was their Simchat Torah. They were holding the children up in their arms. And just to add a little tidbit, later it became known that the child that this Leo Goldman was holding in his arms was Abe Foxman, who was sent from the head of the ADL, a former head of the ADL, who was sent to live in with nuns, I think, with Catholics, whatever, and later went back to the shul. And so both he and Leo Goldman went into Jewish education or the rabbinate or whatever it is. Anyway, this analogy between children and Torah is something that we should hold very, very dear, and maybe even think about when Tisha B'Av comes along as well.